Doctors love to use humor.
Well, Mr. Foster, your blood tests are back, and the good news is you're not pregnant.
Because you're
I said not pregnant. Is this thing on? But unfortunately, the CAT scans are just a laceration in your spleen, which is why I asked for a surgical consult.
Captain, how soon can you land?
I can't tell.
You can tell me I'm a doctor.
No, I mean I'm just not sure.
Or can't you take a guess?
Well, not for another 2 hours.
You can't take a guess for another 2 hours?
I think I'm just a little on edge.
Look, I apologize too. I behaved very unprofessionally.
It's just that I'm really frustrated because I can't seem to kick this habit.
So listen, may I suggest something that seems to have worked for many of my patients?
Changing doctors?
I'm a qualified doctor. I don't want to learn a new trade.
Can I help you?
Yeah, Dr. Cosmo Kramer. Proctology.
Before you even consider this, I insist you consult a doctor.
What's up, Doc?
Doctor, doctor, can't you see I'm burning, burning? Oh, doctor, doctor.
Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. It's time for the Wednesday house call. We're taking your health-related questions at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, free phone call. 1-800-580-CFRA, 26 degrees and sunny. Yes. Isn't it fantastic?
Absolutely fabulous.
I just want to bring you some of the highlights. You'll find this of interest because the Auditor General is out with his report. Jim McCarter, the Auditor General of Ontario, out with his report following his investigation into the Orange Air Ambulance Service. Now, one thing that I learned today in reading this report about the Orange Air Ambulance Service, we think about, you know, say a terrible accident happens on the Queensway or a highway, the Gardiner Expressway, something like that, and the helicopter lands and takes off and rushes the person right to the hospital. That's actually only about 5% of the service provided by Orange Air Ambulance Service. In fact, the bulk of the service is shuttling a patient
transport
from one facility to another. Say a rural hospital to a bigger hospital where more complex care can be achieved. Organ transplants, those kinds of things.
And the support systems on the helicopter, it's literally like a small emergency room where they have a lot of the equipment that you would not necessarily have on the ambulance. And also sometimes traveling by ambulance just longer distance if patients are unstable, it increases their risk.
Now, one of the problems that was highlighted in the Auditor General's report today was the cost of the Orange Air Ambulance Service continued to increase, but the number of those transfers that they were doing was actually on the decline. And there's no real good explanation as to why they were on the decline, but one of the problems with patient care is that if the Orange Air Ambulance Service is on the decline, the number of patient transfers that they're doing, they were expected for the amount of money that they were given each year to provide, say, X amount of transfers, but they were only meeting 15% of that figure. That puts more strain on land ambulance to do those transfers from facility to facility, taking those ambulances away from critical emergency responses, causing a huge strain on the municipality's ability to adequately provide land ambulance service to their residents. That was one of the problems.
So in effect, they gave them global funding for a certain number. Sort of a quota. And
I believe it was around 20,000 a year or something like that.
Right, and because they didn't meet the quota, they still got that money, but no other service was forthcoming.
Yeah. The top five senior executives at Orange, he says, weren't telling the truth when they claimed that their total compensation between five people was $2.5 million annually. It was actually much higher, and the AG says because of the number of private entities, he doesn't exactly know how much they made. Six board members were making a combined $643,000 a year. Board members, they meet half a dozen times a year. One board member, the chair, was on a $200,000 annual retainer. He says it wasn't illegal to get paid that much, but the compensation was rich by any measure. Self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's been widely reported, mainly in the Toronto Star and on this radio station, that when Orange was created back in 2005, the executives and the board members quickly went to work to create a complex web of private companies. And this is outlined in the auditor's report. And he says he's still not done identifying them all, that there may be more. But he has identified 14 private entities created out of the Orange Air Ambulance Service with the funding provided by provincial taxpayers.
So this they did right at the beginning. Is that what
you're
being implied?
Oh, yes.
So,
they went right to work.
All right.
Names like J. Smarts, Orange Global Real Estate, Orange Holdings LP, three different trusts and trustee organizations. He says that his staff tried to get to the bottom of things in the private entities, but they were denied access, saying that these are private companies, they are outside the reach of public investigators, and that Orange actually went so far as to bring in its own lawyers, which were paid with taxpayer money.
That's great.
They renovated the headquarters in Mississauga. It is now nefariously known as the Crystal Palace. Mm-hmm. It was handed $15 million in public money to do that. It's immediately sold the building and made a $9 million profit and then leased it back at a 40% markup. It sold it to another one of the private entities, and nobody can account for the $9 million difference. They purchased for $148 million U.S. 12 helicopters, which are supposed to be air ambulances, but a number were converted into passenger aircraft seating as many as 12 people. $500,000 U.S. of taxpayer money was spent building custom-made orange-colored motorcycles to promote the organization on an American TV show. One is on display right now in the lobby of the Crystal Palace, and nobody knows where the other one is. All of this at a time when, again, the annual funding for air ambulance service was moving up, but the number of patient trips was on the decline. And Jim McCarter made it clear today that the Minister of Health had no idea what was going on. And in fact, as far back as June of last year, his staff tried to convince the Minister of Health that an investigation was needed. She said it wasn't needed and changes were only made. In fact, when articles started appearing outlining these things in the Toronto Star.
So if they, what struck me, Rob, is when you said that immediately they set up these other companies. So if someone is going to do that, they must know in advance that whatever they're about to receive is going to be more than what they actually need to provide whatever service they've been asked to do, and therefore already had.
Well, no, that's not what they did. That's not what they did. They received funding from the provincial government. But
right.
What they also did was they issued $300 million worth of bonds.
Okay.
To help set up these private entities. This is one of the executives there right now was part of this. He was encouraged, the allegation is, he was encouraged to even embellish his resume and say that he had an MBA that he didn't have because it would look good to investors. This is one of these private entities. One of the trusts was created to actually sell these bonds. And taxpayer the repayment of those bonds is being done with $26 million a year of taxpayer money. And on and on and on it goes. So there are new calls today for the resignation of the health minister in light of this. If she wasn't convinced that there were problems at Orange, can she be trusted to run the largest bureaucracy in the provincial government that consumes 42 cents on the dollar?
Well, it certainly is troubling just in terms of the what the Ministry of Health has done with regards to e-health. And it's just the waste of money. And it's the same process that seems to happen. With e-health, you had the same thing. People earning exorbitant amounts of money for really not providing any service. And here you have another company allegedly being, you know, in the auditor's report saying that they were lavishly spending money on themselves without producing anything for the public good.
Right.
You know, it's one thing if you're a private company, you do that. But if you're a public company or at least receiving money from public funding for your service, it has to be above board. And I'm just disappointed. I'm not surprised. I don't even get angry over this stuff anymore because it's just more of the same. And which leads me to comment on what you just said, Rob, that what else is going on in the health ministry with regards to funding of various services where money is not being well spent?
Let me play you one clip of the Auditor General. You'll hear him in full this afternoon on CFRA right after the 5 o'clock news.
They deliberately did not give us what I would call a straight and fulsome answer all the time, and they really made it difficult for us to get all the information. At the end of the day, we were finally able to get the information, you know, for the most part. I mean, when it comes to that myriad of corporate structure, it's interesting. We were in one of the meetings with they had to bring the lawyers in to explain it because they couldn't explain it. They had to bring the lawyers in. And in one of the meetings, the lawyers couldn't even explain. And one of our staff members had to step in and say, well, we think it worked this way. So it was just, it was a very complex situation.
Auditor, do you know where they would get the money, where Orange would get the money to hire a team of expensive, no doubt, lawyers to say no to you? Do you think
$300 million in bond financing.
So they use taxpayers' money to hire lawyers
they
to
would
say
no they Orange would say, oh, auditor, no, that has nothing to do with the taxpayers.
An independent. What would you say?
We would say, well, who's paying the principal? Who's paying the interest? The taxpayers are making the interest and the principal payments on the money. They would say, well, auditor, we'll bring in the lawyers to facilitate your understanding of this transaction. That's how it would be explained to us. And are you sure you want to, auditors, are you really sure? We know you're trying to get your audit wrapped up. Are you really sure that you want to go through all that? Are you sure your understanding isn't enough? And we basically said, bring the lawyers in. We saw the appearance of possible self-interest that we questioned whether was appropriate. And hence, that's where we went to the ministry and said to the, you know, to the watchdog, this doesn't pass the smell test. You know, ministry, are you sure that you're comfortable with this? And a lot of this, they just did not have the information. We were bringing information to them that they were just unaware of. And, you know, they indicated to us, well, auditor, we're not sure we can get that information under the existing performance agreement. I think the ministry, should have been much more skeptical in ensuring that their external service provider was doing the job they should be doing. I think they had an unrealistic, perhaps, amount of trust in the service that was being delivered by Orange. And again, when we initially presented them with many of the issues and the observations, they were not convinced. They were not immediately convinced that there were some serious issues at Orange.
So the auditor, you'll hear from him. I talked to him this afternoon at length.
Very interesting.
Jim McCarter. That's on right after the 5 o'clock news. Frank Cleese is going to join us. He's been all over this file for the Progressive Conservatives. Franz Jelena is the NDP member for Nickel Belt. She's been all over this file. They're all going to join me this afternoon. But
it just makes me really disappointed, I would say, in a way, that the money that you see just going down the drain. And we talk all the time. People call up, Rob. We get questions, and we're probably going to get questions from people today where you know, there are certain treatments that are available that are not covered, that they say they can't afford. And yet you see this money going down the drain that would very easily cover
some hospitals,
a lot of
it was learned this week, are going to have their budgets cut by 3%. They're going after the nurses. They're going after the teachers. They want to freeze doctor salaries in Ontario. So that's why it's so maddening when you hear things like this, right?
Well, yeah, it has to go for patient care. You know, if the money is being spent and people are being served appropriately, whatever someone is paid, if they're getting value for what you're paying for, that's okay. But you're getting a situation where you're seeing money just disappear and never to be reclaimed again, and they're unlikely to get this money back.
Ken, thanks for being patient, sir. Go ahead with your question for Dr. Dworkin.
Thank you. Dr. Dworkin,
yes.
I'm sorry to get away from your topic today, but my interest is with the dangers of VRE.
Mm-hmm.
And to give you a little story, my wife broke her hip and she went to hospital number one where she was diagnosed. The repair was done in hospital number two, and from there she went back to hospital number one for physio and found that as a result of her visit to hospital number two, she picked up VRE.
Mm-hmm.
Now, had we not gone back to hospital number one for physio, we would never have known that she had picked up the VRE. And we're wondering about the dangers of this infection to a newborn infant.
It would probably be, again, for a newborn infant, if she has VRE, which is vancomycin-resistant enterococci, for our listeners,
yes.
It is usually picked up in hospitals, usually from contamination, sometimes as well. People treated with lots of antibiotics, it destroys their normal, what we call the gut flora, which is the bacteria which is in the intestine. See that in surgical patients as well, because they're just more prone to have postoperative infections. But if for an infant to catch this would mean the infant would have to have direct contact with the person. And in some ways also the infection would be, I would say, difficult to transmit from one to another, just in terms of the fact that it really requires an unhygienic situation. That is, person goes to the bathroom, they're not washing their hands. Yeah. So there are those kind of things. Usually these people are isolated, so they're until the infection is controlled. So when you, for example, in the hospitals, you have to put on gowns, masks, and gloves before you go into the room. So if she does have VRE, usually you have to use those particular precautions. And with anything, especially for a newborn baby or an infant, you just keep the infant away until she has completely cleared the infection as a means of preventing it. So my advice would be, even in the most hygienic of circumstances, it's just better, you're better off not having that kind of contact until things clear up.
Okay. Thanks for your call, Ken. More of your phone calls after the 3:30 news with Dr. Barry Dworkin and the Wednesday House Call. .342-580-CFRA. I'm going to be recapturing some of my wasted youth tonight, Dr. Dworkin.
You going to Van Halen?
I'm going to Van Halen out at Scotiabank Place. I haven't been to a rock concert in I don't know how long. It's been a long time. More than 10 years, probably. Our news anchor, Sean Connolly, is also going tonight, and he is a very experienced headbanger. He likes the rock and roll, and he goes to concerts all the time. And he said, "Did you bring earplugs?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, you're going to be up all night." He brings earplugs to the concert. He's probably the smart one, right?
He's very smart.
I'm right down on the lower bowl near the front because this is my favorite band from my childhood, right? So I got to go see them. A once-in-a-lifetime thing.
Yeah.
It's going to be loud.
Yeah.
Do you think my hearing will be damaged tonight?
I would wear some earplugs.
Really? Yeah, I'm not going to wear earplugs. I'm leaving, you know, at 6:30 to rush out there.
Yeah, depending on where you are, and you sit in front of a speaker, it's damaging to the ear. Let's face it. Yeah.
Permanent or?
May not be. If you get ringing in your ears, it means you've caused damage.
Right.
And so you have.
I mean, this is like one rock concert in 10 years.
Yeah. It's as with anything with regards to anything that can harm you.
Yeah.
It's the dose. So in other words, how many decibels this
is. I'm hoping to get a lot of.
The decibel
dose tonight.
The duration of exposure.
It'll be about 90 minutes.
So, and you know, it's if you're sitting in front of a speaker that's as loud, 120 decibels is considered to be jet engine loud.
Okay.
So if you're sitting in front of that, think of standing in front of a jet engine for 90 minutes, right? It's going to be loud. It can potentially damage the ear, whether it'll be permanent or not.
I don't know. I've been wearing headphones for 15 years on the radio.
Yeah, except you're not doing 120 decibels, Rob.
Yeah. But I do find it, you know, after being in the radio biz and you listen to everything through headphones, my hearing is not the greatest hearing in the world. I will admit that.
Right.
But I've got to listen to the TV a little louder than most people.
You know, I remember going to rock concerts. I used to do, in Montreal, I was a volunteer for St. John's Ambulance. And so you'd get into the forum. You just walk in the side door, and you get into the hockey games and the rock concerts. You can go backstage. You can do anything. But wore earplugs all the time.
Nerd.
I got to see every rock concert that came to Montreal. Yeah. So it was,
and your hearing is still good.
My hearing is still good.
There you go. Okay. 521 talk *580 1-800-580-CFRA. Call now while we can still hear you. Mustafa.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, doctor.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, thank you for the great show. I always enjoy your show, and I find it very helpful.
Thank you.
Yeah, doctor, recently my wife has noticed that she's losing a lot of hair.
Mm-hmm.
She's a diabetic, but the diabetes seems to be under control. gone to the family doctor twice, and they're going to refer her to the specialist, but the specialist appointment is going to be
6 months from now, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So what are our options? Because every time she brushes her hair, there's a pile of hair that comes out, and is very nervous and very concerned.
Well, there are a few things that can be done. This is called androgenetic alopecia is the fancy term. It simply means male-determined hair loss, not male-determined as in X chromosome, but just the androgens that are in both men and women that right. can have an effect how the body converts them into another compound that can promote hair loss. Right. And in men, there are things that you can take to block that conversion. But for women, especially of childbearing age, you can't use these medications because it interferes with other hormonal systems. But okay. for women, there are some things that can be used. There's a topical agent called minoxidil. Rogaine is the brand name, but it's called minoxidil, 2% minoxidil.
Right.
It's applied to the scalp every day. And there is some response with regards to hair growth. Ultimately, though, what we would want to figure out is the cause. For many women, it is a testosterone-based problem. That is, they're making too much of what we call 5-hydroxytestosterone or 5-HT.
Right.
And this is the hormonal component that I was mentioning, that 5-HT comes from testosterone. It's converted. And there is a medication that blocks that conversion, but you can't use that in women, especially prior to menopause. You can certainly use that in men, and it can help preserve and sometimes even bring back in some cases, depending on how progressed the how early you catch the hair loss, can bring back some of the hair. So
right.
so minoxidil does help a little bit. It's not perfect, but it's one particular option.
Okay.
You can use, again, the what's called finasteride in women, but it's usually after. It's in postmenopausal women, so women who have already had their children, their periods have stopped, they're in menopause where you could particularly use this. But there's not very many studies that have shown how well this works in women. It's just another potential treatment. There is also another medication called spironolactone, which is a another type of medication that can sometimes help promote hair growth. But it's usually used if minoxidil does not work. So usually the first step would be the minoxidil for your wife to look at, but she has to discuss this with her doctor. Minoxidil was originally designed as a blood pressure medication, found that it wasn't a really good blood pressure medication, but it did cause some hair growth in the studies that were done, which is why they've turned this into a topical solution. So that would be sort of a stopgap until you're able to see the dermatologist, because I know dermatologist is about a 6 month waiting list to see them. So I would discuss that have her discuss this with her family doctor as a possibility. It's relatively harmless to use this on the scalp because there's really very little absorption past the scalp layer. And that way it'd be certainly something for at least for her to try. It doesn't work right away. So you're still looking at using it for several months before you can notice if there's any change. Other things to look for just as a means of making sure that nothing else is being missed. Thyroid function, the certain blood tests that are done to just evaluate testosterone levels, those kind of things, just to see if you can find out if there are any other factors contributing to this hair loss.
This will be the last call on the Wednesday House Call, and it's Dan in Merrickville. Go ahead, sir.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Afternoon.
I have a swelling of my lower left leg when I got back from Cuba on Sunday. The doctor thought that it was a blood clot to begin with, and then after an ultrasound, decided that it was a Baker's cyst.
Yes.
And I went back to work today after 2 days off and found that the swelling has become worse. I'm just wondering, how long it takes for something like this to pass naturally. Does it pass naturally, or is there, after 2 weeks, they said come back and see us? It's painful and swollen. It almost looks like stretched cellophane that the calf muscle has gotten so big. Any advice?
Yeah, first off, the calf muscle, if it's large, is it red and hot or is it just large?
It's warm. It's not really red.
Okay. So that's a good thing. And you had the ultrasound to look at the veins and there was nothing there?
Correct.
Okay. So what a Baker cyst is usually for people who have osteoarthritis of the knee, a Baker cyst is an extension of that arthritis where you get fluid accumulation. There's a sac that forms behind the knee, that area of the knee that sort of hole behind the knee when you touch behind there, is called the popliteal fossa. And so the cyst will accumulate fluid in that area, and if it gets too large or if there's too much pressure, it will rupture. And when it ruptures, the fluid that is in that cyst will travel down between the skin layers and the muscle layers into the calf, which leads to the pain you're experiencing and also causes local inflammation because it's irritating to the tissue. It takes about 2 or 3 weeks for the body to reabsorb all that fluid and to reduce, and for the inflammation to reduce. So it is very painful in terms of long-term harm, not very much at all. It's more irritating to the tissue. What you do have to look out for is if the calf muscle becomes, the calf becomes extremely red and hot, which would indicate infection. But I'm at least satisfied that you had the ultrasound so that we've disproven that there's any deep vein blood clot. And as a result, you're just simply looking at symptomatic relief, keeping the leg elevated when you can, applying ice to the area to try and keep the swelling down. But ultimately, it's the effect of the liquid that was in the cyst that has irritated the skin, caused the inflammation, and caused the swelling. And because that type of thing does progress over several days, it's not surprising that the leg is more swollen than it originally was, because the inflammatory process really is just following what we would expect it to do. But within the week, it should certainly decompress a bit. And usually 2 to 3 weeks later, it disappears.
Okay. Good luck, Dan. Thanks for the call. Thanks for all your time today.
You're very welcome.
Good to see you. Enjoy the rest of this great weather.
I indeed will.
I'm told we're in for a rude awakening this weekend. But
it's only March.
Dr. Barry Dworkin on the Wednesday House Call. He's back Sunday at 4. And don't forget, health headlines every morning at 10 to 7 during Madeley in the Morning.